Did you know that over 60,000 new tracks are uploaded to Spotify every single day? That's a new track every 1.4 seconds, and that's just on one platform. With so much music now available, it's more important than ever to stand out from the crowd. So it's not surprising that more artists are starting to use less conventional sonic textures in their music, like field recordings. Perhaps you've always wanted to infuse the sounds of nature or your favourite city into your own tracks, but not having the right gear or knowledge might have held you back. Well, if that's the case, you're going to love the brand new guide I just created teaching you how to start field recording with just a smartphone, and it's all yours for free at femalediymusician.com/learnwithisabel. Yep, you really do just need a humble smartphone and some minimal extra gear that doesn't have to break the bank to get started with field recording. And I've laid it all out in this handy 5-point checklist. So download it for free at femalediymusician.com/learnwithisabel and elevate your music to the next level.
There's one DJ, Pam the Funktress. She was Prince's DJ. And there was one point where, like, there's a clip of her scratching, but using her chest and just like,
wow.
Yeah, it's sick. It blew my mind.
Oh my God, I love that.
So she was
wonderful. That's so good. That is so good.
It's just, yeah, just like in any way, shape, or form, like people can just express themselves more with their literal bodies. There's a lot you can do with it. And it's just been like exploring that in my own way.
Hello and welcome to Girls Twiddling Knobs. My name's Isabel, and over the last decade, my self-produced and self-released music has amassed over 25 million Spotify streams. I also have a PhD in sonic arts, but I wasn't always this confident with music tech. In fact, I still hear those self-doubt gremlins in my head from time to time. I started this podcast to help more female-identifying musicians start recording and producing their music and learn from other women making music with technology. If that's your cup of tea, then you're in the right place, my friend. Let's dive in. This podcast is fascinating and insightful. The conversations are so interesting that even when there is no guest and Isabel is musing on a topic by herself, you get a really considered point of view on music, tech, and creativity. Can't recommend enough. Thank you. No, I wasn't just spilling out my own inner self-congratulating thoughts at you, dear listener. That was instead a shout out for a real life knob twiddling superfan. Thank you so much, Starry Buck, for your glowing review. It means the world to know these episodes are hitting the spot. And if you also love tuning in with me each week and want a shout out from me to you, just rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening from right now. Whether you're a loyal lady listener, a magnificent male ally, or some flavour all your own, press pause and do it now, because it really does help even more women and girls discover this amazing space. Well, welcome to another episode of Girls Twiddling Knobs, and the first one of May, which for me is the month where summer truly begins here in the southeast of England. This week, we're following on from last week's episode, somewhat because we're joined by an artist who uses field recordings in her work. Nick Knack, aka Nicole Raymond, is a DJ and turntablist, sound artist, composer, producer, tutor, sound engineer, and radio presenter and 2020 ORAM Award winner to boot. When we met, we covered so many interesting topics that I decided I had to make this a two-parter. In this first episode, I asked Nicole how she started using turntables and making music, and I also asked the poor lady to talk me, a total novice, through some turntable techniques. Apologies, Nicole. She also shares her take on learning and making and how, rather than words like should and must, it's so much more important to stay open and listen to your own instinct when it comes to making music with technology. I think you're going to love this episode, so let's dive in. So welcome, Nicole, to Girls Twiddling Knobs. It is so, so wonderful to have you here.
And yeah, I can't wait to get into everything that we're going to chat about. But firstly, please, can you just introduce yourself a little bit in your own words?
Firstly, thank you for having me, Isabel. Really, really happy to be here. I am a music creative. I think that's the best way to kind of describe what I do. My artist / DJ name is Nick Knack. I am a turntablist, a producer, sound engineer, and obviously sirens go by as I mention my name because I'm that amazing.
Love it. You are like driving Leeds crazy every day.
Just calm down, calm down. Jeez, I'm just on a podcast. Chill.
God, they won't leave you alone.
Paparazzi. Jeez. Turntablist, DJ, sound artist, producer, lecturer,
radio presenter.
Radio presenter. I also run events. I do a lot. So kind of put it into one amorphous thing would be a music creative, because everything I do centers around music and mainly centers around the tech I use, which are turntables. I've been making music in some way, shape or form for about over 15 years now, based in Leeds, although I don't have a ridiculously thick Yorkshire accent.
No.
From London originally, studied in Leicester at DMU and then came up to Leeds to do my master's. And I seemingly I'm basically attracted to places that begin with L. So I might move to Loughborough next, or Leamington Spa. We don't know yet. Or maybe a different letter in the alphabet. Who knows? But and I also collect comics. There you go.
Great. What kind of comics do you collect?
X-Men.
Okay. Great. Okay. Wow. Wonderful. Well, like you say, that you cover a lot of bases, but obviously it's centering around music. And there's a particular technology that you're interested in, turntablism. And so maybe you could tell me a little bit about, firstly, what is it about turntablism that you're interested in, or that, you know, makes you want to keep using that? But also, how did you even get started as well?
So how I got started was essentially, without going too far back into like my childhood and stuff and just being around music anyway, but turntablism in particular caught my eye when a lady called Sophie Smith, I think it's, yeah, Sophie Smith, she came and did a lecture at DMU a number of years back. And at that point, I'd heard of turntablism. Like, I kind of just assumed, oh yeah, so it's scratching and that's synonymous with hip hop and things like that. But her lecture really widened the scope for me. She talked about like the Musique Concrète, Pierre Schaeffer. She talked about John Cage and how they, you know, those people essentially just messed around with turntables in their time, and how that's gone into like the DMCs, which is like a really popular competition, and there's other ones around the world too, but DMCs are like one of the most well-known ones, and kind of introduced me to the weird and wonderful side as well. So people like Mariam Rezai or Shiva Feshtereki, as well as talking about like it's more than people scratching on a beat. It's so much more to it. So she was kind of the catalyst. And then while I was DJing, kind of or at least starting out in Leicester and just trying to figure out what I want to do, like, oh well, this is all right. I made some friends who were in a DJ collective called Bug Out, and they could all scratch. So a really interesting moment happened where, like, I got to, instead of working behind the bar where Bug Out did their Friday nights, I was given a chance to do a set. Did a set. They were really cool and were like, yeah, you're part of the crew now. That was dope. I was like, oh, thanks, guys. And then slowly it became like, oh, there's some nights where I'm working behind the bar and there's some nights where I'm actually DJing at that same bar, and kind of managing those two things. And slowly the DJing overtook to the point where I didn't have to work at the bar anymore.
And you're like, bye, guys.
Just like...
Little bit busy.
It's like, but no, like for real, it was cool. And then kind of getting interested in just learning more, and like I'd watch my friends do these intricate like routines and stuff, and just yeah, I kind of picked up some ideas from them and learned from them. I also became friends with a guy called John First, who is. He won the online DMCs in like 2013. And yeah, at one point in time, he was my neighbor, which is so funny to think about. But I won a competition where I got to like learn a few things from him. So yeah, kind of got to jam with him a couple times and learned some skills from him. And then, yeah, it just kind of built up over the years to the point where I felt comfortable just doing it in my own way. Like there are like fundamental parts to turntablism, like this is this kind of scratch, this is this kind of scratch. Yeah, that, so those people were kind of like the main kind of introductory catalysts. Mm-hmm. for my practice. And then I obviously just got used to working in this way and just felt really comfortable doing it in this way. I feel like turntablism is way more expressive than, especially live, like you see people doing tricks and stuff. And like there's one DJ, Pam the Funktress, I'm really bad with names, but she was somebody, she was Prince's DJ. And it was one point where like there's a clip of her scratching, but using her chest and just like,
wow.
Just moving it. Yeah, it's sick. It blew my mind.
Oh my God,
yo.
I love that.
So she was
that's
like,
yep, wonderful. That's so good. That is so good.
It's just like, ah, yes. So it's just, yeah, just like in any way, shape or form, like people can just express themselves more, yeah, with like their literal bodies with the turntable and in effects. And there's a lot you can do with it. And yeah, it's just been like exploring that in my own way.
So you're not doing scratching with your chest then, Nicole?
Do you know what? I wish. You know, she like rest in eternal peace, because she's a queen. She is, when you see the clip, you'll understand why I can't do that. Because she's like, how can I say this? She was very buxom.
Very well endowed, yeah. In the chess department, yeah.
She's cool. She's
yeah, we
cool.
Don't all have that talent. Yeah, no. I get it. Yeah,
that's the way they're doing it, and I fully respect that. You know,
I love that. But but I also I can really imagine what you're talking about in terms of how attractive that is. That it's so expressive and it's so physical and it's so performative, and. You know, when you're thinking about a lot of those seminal, very kind of experimental avant-garde musicians like John Cage or, you know, Pierre Schaeffer, people like that, it's not quite got the same performative nature in terms of them as artists and composers. But I also think it's a really, really interesting link that you're making there, that this came out of people experimenting in those sort of more traditional or, well, very white male environments of the academy, yeah. You know, where people had labs and people had workshops. And I think that it's interesting seeing how that's just, I never think of DJing in any way connected with that, which is crazy, because obviously there's a massive connection in the turntable and those techniques as well. And I love the fact that you're making that link and that your work is making that link. I think that's really important.
Thank you. It's a bit of education that people don't realize. Like I didn't clock it until I studied at uni, but that isn't to say that you need to study at uni to know that connection, because it's kind of obvious. Like you've got, there's clips of John Cage just messing about with everyday appliances. I think he did it in front of a live audience at one point, like just, yeah, like, I don't know, maybe half an hour or something. And one of those items is a turntable, but he hits it. Like he's not scratching or anything. He's just literally making noises physically on the turntable, but it makes a noise, and he adds that into his overall performance. So like it is an instrument. He chose to perform it in that way for that particular showing or whatever, but like it's still an instrument. And I think more and more people need to realize that.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. And I think it's not to detract from anything that, you know, people like John Cage or Pierre Schaeffer did, and that they were in their time, in their circles, incredibly, you know, subversive. And so it's interesting seeing this kind of blending of more contemporary use of the turntable that you're doing with that lineage as well. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Maybe I just want to backtrack a little bit. You said there's some kind of basic or really common turntable techniques, but for most of us who have never laid our hands on a record and tried any of that, what are they? Can you just maybe give us three or something?
Yes. So there is they're literally named after what they sound like. So there's the baby, which sounds like a baby. It's hard to kind of
Nicole, when you said that they're named like what they sound like, when you said that, I was not expecting you to say baby.
Yeah.
Okay, but maybe I'd know that sound if I heard it, right?
Yeah, you would know it if you heard it. It's kind of it's like, so that, yeah, they're named after what they sound like, and the action that you do on the mixer and the turntable, like on the sound vinyl, help to make that sound. So there's one that's called the baby. There's another one called chirp, which is a bird chirping essentially. So it's quite a short sound. And there's a scratch called the crab, where that one in particular is more concentrating on your hand movements. So you're moving your fingers like a crab.
Oh, nice.
Like really, really quickly. So it's that they tend to be quite short names because they're short sounds.
Yeah.
But then so yeah, you could use a multitude of those scratches in your performance.
Great.
Those are the first three. Yeah.
That's really, I love the combination of the hand actions, the sound and everything in the name. And so the crab, you're making that kind of crab shape very quickly on the actual record.
Yeah.
How do you do the baby? What's that?
The baby is, I'm going to have to try and, I'm going to have to like actually mimic it. So the baby is like you let the sound go on the turntable, and then you cut it off on the mixer.
Right.
So like you kind of let it go like bah, and then stop, and then you bring it back bah, and then bring it back bah, and then while you're kind of holding on to the turntable, this is really hard to do over Zoom. When you're like every time you close the sound, so when I start making that sound, that's me moving the crossfader back to the other deck, so bat bat like that. So in kind of while you're doing it, like in a performance, it could be like bat 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 bat, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Chirp is a shorter version of baby, and it just literally sounds like a bird chirping, so that's quite self-explanatory.
And what do you do physically to do that?
So so if you think about it in terms of maths, the chirp is essentially half of a baby.
Okay.
So bat bat could be a chirp. Bat bat. It's hard to do. Ah man.
Yeah.
I wish I had if I had my stuff in front of me, it would make more sense.
Yeah, yeah. No, no. It's just interesting, like, because for people who have never done this before, It's interesting to know just the amount of, it sounds like you have to have ridiculously quick reflexes. like the physical, yes. You know what I mean? Like multitasking, yeah. You know?
I know for a fact that there will be people, well, I say I know for a fact, but like people listening to this, you know, when you hear someone scratching, they're using a variety of all of those sounds and more. Like those, the chirp, the baby and the crab, they're all ones that just came to mind like in that moment. There's a fair bit more. And when I scratch, it's just an improvised motion. Like I know I'm using those techniques. I wouldn't be able to tell you in that moment, oh yeah, that was definitely,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it just happens, kind of like when, I don't know, when a guitarist or somebody is like playing a guitar and they might use a certain hand movement to get to the notes or whatever, they may or may not be able to tell you, oh, I did that technique to get to that.
I totally get what you're saying. I mean, of course, yeah. You have internalized all of that. And like you say, it's an intuitive, playful, creative thing where you're not analyzing. I mean, I wouldn't be able to do this either. You're not analyzing every single second of, I'm going to do this thing and then I'll do this thing. And then I did that, and then I did that. Some people's brains do work like that. Mine doesn't. I mean, we've talked about this a little bit before we came on to record, but particularly I think if you're dyslexic, it can be hard to just be like break down every single thing in detailed kind of terminology. It's more about a sensing, a feeling, an incorporation of things that you've soaked up over the years. You may or may not even remember what you're doing or why you're doing it, but then it's a more of a, yeah, it's a different kind of knowing and doing.
Yeah.
So, well, maybe that kind of is a good segue into dyslexia. And because we talked about this a bit, I told you I did a whole episode on dyslexia and how I thought it might have impacted my ability to learn, but also my talents in terms of music production as well. So the challenges and the pluses. So how about you? How do you think dyslexia has informed your practice with music, with turntablism, what you're doing?
That's a really good question. I think, I first learned that I was dyslexic during my second year of uni. And that was kind of in the kind of midway point before taking it a bit more seriously and stuff like that. So that initial, like getting that diagnosis was really helpful because I was really struggling, like doing essays and just understanding what these big words and things. I mean, even if you're not dyslexic, uni can be quite a weird time of just adjusting to the things. And so when they're telling you to write these essays and talk about people that you may or may not connect with, it can be quite daunting. So added learning difficulty on top of it is like, what? But I'm very grateful to have had that help to help me get through it. But yeah, it really did help me understand myself more. And then kind of going on from that, it gave me more confidence to try out these things and at least just say, okay, well, I have an idea and I'm going to just see what happens with it, and not feel weird if the way that I explain my idea makes sense to me but maybe not to the other person. Do you know what I mean? Like it's kind of trying to think of an example, but basically, yeah, it was very like, okay, I have an idea, this is what it is, and I can explain it in my way. And if you want me to change how I explain it so you get it, that's fine. But let me explain it my way first because I'm finally comfortable with relaying that back to me. Mm. And then putting that into practice with the turntablism. So while I was learning, you know, through like friends and other people and other sources, when I felt comfortable to at least try on my own, like I knew that like, okay, the exact way that this person showed me how to do the chirp scratch or the baby scratch or something, cool, but I'm finding I'm doing something else now.
Mm-hmm.
Something else is happening. So I'm making other sounds happen now. And I am so fine with that. Like I understand the basics of what was explained to me, like literally, oh, this is how you do this. Cool, but now I'm finding other sounds
Yeah.
And then I found myself over a number of years going more into the sounds that I was finding.
Yeah, yeah.
Being more comfortable with that.
Yeah. Do you know what, Nicole? Like, I so relate to you here. And actually, you know, I would even go as far as to say, I don't remember the basics. Like, I have to, when I'm teaching music production, I have to go and pretty much nearly every time remind myself, even really simple things like, what is bit depth? What is that? What's bit depth? If I'm going to teach people to use a bit depth of 24, I need to know what the bit depth is. And because of having dyslexia, I find it really hard for that to just sink in as random, trivial knowledge. You know, it doesn't stay in my brain. I have to constantly keep referencing it. When I was doing my PhD, I had this very, very organized way of referencing all of the things that I was drawing from to do my thesis and all my pieces, because I could not retain people's names, the books, the pieces of music in my head. They just don't stay there. So I would go as far as to say with that, I don't always retain the basics even. But what happens for me is exactly like you're saying, I start finding these other ways that just come, you know, from me doing stuff. And I sometimes draw on the basics, and then I sometimes draw on more advanced techniques. And then I often find myself bringing things together in ways that I just haven't been taught, but just are interesting and feel good, you know, and I don't overanalyze that either. I just go with it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But what then happens is that you can then be in situations where people are wanting you to relay that back in very traditional kind of terminology heavy ways. And it doesn't work like that, you know? It doesn't make it bad music, and it doesn't make me a bad artist. It's just that we're in a society that requires us to communicate things in certain ways.
And I think that needs to go away, because it can be very disheartening if you're like, you know, you're somebody with a whole bunch of experience, and you know what you're talking about, you know what you do, but yet if you can't explain something in one particular kind of a way, then it's seen as, well, she's not as clued up as we thought, or something, you know. People can
do you ever feel like that, Nicole? Have you ever experienced that?
I have experienced that. It's you know, I'm dyslexic, and I'm kind of waiting to find out about ADHD as well. So, you know, I'm still figuring things out. I endeavor to be open-minded, because that's the only way to be, really. There's so much, even in terms of tech, like there's so much going on. Like, you can get these, what they're called, kind of essentially needle replacements, and they're Bluetooth, and you can pick up a record and start scratching with it with your hand in the air and stuff.
Wow.
It's ridiculous, but like, I know about them. If I was so fixed on, I need a turntable and a needle and blah, if I was so fixed on that, then I wouldn't even look at phase, but there you are. But like, yeah, there's been times when whenever I've done like lectures or workshops or whatever, and the way that I talk is very much me. I really struggle to be like, so today I can't do that unless I'm taking the piss. Like, I can't, you know, even my voice changed then. Like, I can't do that. So when I'm trying to be like, okay, so this is what I do, and this is how I do it, it doesn't mean it's the right way or the wrong way. This is a way of doing this particular thing. And I really try to kind of hammer it home to students, whether that's like in DJ workshops or like lectures or whatever, that like, this is only one, I'm only one person telling you one way of doing a thing. It doesn't mean that this is the only way to do it, because there might be somebody else who comes in who does it in a completely different way, but they're still achieving the same result. Mm. So it's not, you know, and we can talk about, so this is how you compress, but this is not the way of how to compress. There are a lot of different ways of making music, especially now. Like, you don't necessarily need an interface and stuff. I remember one lecture I did in particular talking about like studio spaces and things, and everyone's like, oh, so I need KRKs and I need this, that, and the other. And I was like, look, I've made hip hop albums literally on just my laptop and headphones. I didn't even have a MIDI keyboard.
Yeah.
And I still made stuff. I knew how I wanted them to sound. I knew what, you know, old school boom bap 90s type of stuff. I knew what I wanted it to sound like. And so I did my best to recreate that, and I made it. And I played them to the students, and they were like, "You made this on headphones?" Like, yeah. Yeah. Like, I didn't have, I still don't have my own like MIDI keyboard and whatever, but that's fine, you know.
Yeah.
As my needs as a producer have changed over the years, like, yes, I have turntables now and I have a Chaos pad and stuff because that suits that style of music, but I don't have my own set of KRKs and bits and pieces. It's just like, I don't need that. And that's fine. When I was in uni and college, it was quite like, yeah, if you want to take yourself seriously, you need this stuff. And that's so not the case now. Like, I have I have like really nice, really old speakers. And so I play stuff on there.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, that sounds all right. Or I can, that's my reference because that's how I want it to sound. And if you want to get KRKs, go for it. If you want to get the Yamaha ones with the white cones, go for it. If you don't want to get anything, you just want to invest in some really good like monitor headphones, go for that too. It's totally what you want.
I love that you said this. No, I love that you said this, Nicole, because this is so much about what I try and emphasize on this podcast and what I emphasize with my students. And something I'm kind of interested in is, so for me, I sometimes wonder if there's something about my dyslexia where I'm not very interested in amassing and cataloging a bunch of gear. I've never been like that. I don't want the idea of having loads of microphones and loads of different bits of kit kind of slightly ickies me out, as in it's like, oh no, it's too much. I'm really resourceful as a person in lots of different ways. Like, I love opening the fridge, saying, right, what's in the fridge? I'm going to make a fucking amazing meal out of what's in the fridge. And I think I'm quite like that with my music as well. I'm like, what have I got? Right, I'm going to make something really fucking amazing with what I've got. Do you relate to that? Does that ring true with you?
How can I put it? I'm similar in a few ways, and in other ways, I'm not as much. So it's like I use Serato when I DJ and make music. I also use Logic, and it's like, okay, cool. That's me. I'm all right. I also acknowledge that like Ableton is like the place to be right now, and it's a very powerful bit of kit, and I'm looking to incorporate that in what I do. So I'm open to using Ableton. I need to find the right time to dive into it because I'm so used to what I know, if that makes sense. Like, I can appreciate it's very, that Ableton is the shit. Yes, very much so. Yes. It doesn't take away from Logic though.
Yeah.
You know, Logic is my homie, like, yo, but I'm quite like, yeah. And when it comes to kit, my setup is it looks complicated, but it isn't. Like, the most recent thing I got was a Chaos pad, and that was a secondhand one, and was like, okay, that can be added onto what I have. Mm-hmm. Cool. I don't see the need to add anything else really until like, if something breaks, or if it's like, okay, well, I've used this to the point where I now feel restricted. Mm-hmm. Now is when I can get an upgrade. And even when I should have said at the start, I'm also a podcaster. So
yes,
So, you know, I'm looking into getting like a little interface and a microphone specifically for that. Or when I'm doing radio shows from home, get that kind of stuff in for that. But in terms of having like all of the bells and whistles and things, like, yeah, look at me. I've got this and I've got this and I've got it. I can't be arsed, man.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even think I have room to have all of it. Like, if everyone's like, if I won whatever or I made whatever, I would buy a house and make a studio in there. I would just be like, cool, that would be nice. Yeah. But also, where would my comics go?
Yeah.
Where would my vinyl go? Like, I'd probably like be like, no, I'll just put them to one bit and then have a room dedicated to comics and books and shit. I don't know. But
I agree. Like, I've got kit that is very good that I use, but it's what I need. It's no more than what I need, you know.
It's the same thing with like how people I've seen this personally, like how people will try to tell you how to do a thing as if it's the only way to do something. Mm-hmm. We kind of touched on this before, but
yeah,
especially whenever I've been teaching like non-male students about DJing and whatever, and like I say, I do make it very clear that this is my way of doing it. This isn't to say that this is the only way of doing it. So more often than not, the students will be like, oh, my boyfriend or brother or somebody who's male has said that I have to mix like this. Is this right? And I'm like, why are you putting that much? Why are they, the person who showed you the thing, who just happens to be male, a lot of the time they're male, why have they said that you have, it's all in the language, to mix like this? Why do you have to do, you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you're literally playing with sound at the end of the day. So if you wanted to fade out and bring something else in, you can. If you want to try and beat match it, you can. If you want to do something, it's totally up to you. You will find the transition or whatever. You'll find your way of doing it yours, because that's the point. Because no one can mix like, I can't mix like some next person and they can't mix like me. Cool, because it's a different experience. So you can't, for whenever people ask me that question, a bit of me is just like, don't fucking say it like that. Just be like, this is one way of doing it, and then just have it be more open instead of so like
totally
restricted. And I feel like that fully applies to kit as well. Just like, yeah man, you've got to have this. No, I don't.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think, I mean, what I often say to my students is, if you are wanting to make something to an industry standard, this is what people often do, but you don't have to, you know. And I think that's important to say, is like, yeah, if you want to be making something that stands up next to a piece of music that's going to be played on Radio One. But I think, I feel like what we're talking about here is all about confidence at the end of the day, isn't it? It's all about that self-esteem to say, okay, somebody has given me some advice, I don't have to follow it to the letter, and I can interpret it, and I can even just not listen to it at all. But it's that self-esteem to be able to make that decision and make that analysis of, this is helpful to me, this is not so helpful to me, this doesn't feel right to me, or this feels totally me, you know. And it's having that confidence to be able to tell and to work from that gut feeling. And I feel like, what, you know, in your case, for example, Nicole, the music that you have made is truly original. You know, it really is, because you're integrating techniques with a kind of a perception of sound that you often don't hear that combination. And what's coming out is something that does sound original and that is very, very you. And so not everyone wants to make original music, though, and that's fine. Like, I say that without... I'm not saying it with a sneer at all. It's just some people genuinely just want to, you know, remake classic sounding tracks, and that's fine. But if you do want to make something that is, it is truly original, I think you really have to get in touch with that gut feeling, and you have to grow that self-esteem of being able to make those decisions on your terms and take in the advice that is going to help you, and know when there's advice that is too rigid, like you're saying, these words like should or have. And I think a lot of the time they come with this idea of amateur or professional.
Yeah, they were also linked with, firstly, thank you for your kind words. They're also linked with imposter syndrome too. I know that was something that we kind of touched on before coming on to record. I definitely wouldn't have made Bashy and things outside of an academic setting and just put it on Spotify and whatever. I definitely wouldn't have done that if I hadn't overcome my imposter syndrome when it comes to calling myself a turntablist, because that took me years to get really comfortable with what I do. And because again, it was like, well, yeah, people, and I guess like they don't always know what they're saying and how they're saying it. No. Language is more powerful than people realize, yeah. Especially when you're going from, you know, one gender to another, so to speak. So, you know, being in a situation where you've picked up these techniques, but you're using them in a different way, you're finding your own way with it. But then these people who have strictly kind of been like, this is this one and yeah. this one and this one. And they're calling, they are like confidently calling themselves turntablists because they use these techniques yeah. down to the letter, as you say, bam, 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 bam. There's a level of confidence there that somebody who's just finding their way and just experimenting and trying to figure out, you know, what sits right with them, maybe can't, you know, or in my case, I didn't feel like I was able to call myself a turntablist at that point, because it was like, well, I'm in quotation marks not there yet, because I don't feel like this.
Yeah, and the thing is, yeah. like when you're speaking there, Nicole, what I'm thinking in my head is you're saying I'm finding my way, you know, I'm not there yet. No, you're blazing your own trail.
That's the thing. Yeah, that's it. It was, this is what I'm saying. In that moment of like, I don't know, like before the term imposter syndrome came about, I was just yeah. very much sitting in that space of, I don't know, well, you know, I'm in uni and this can go in submission, and you know, yeah. and then not thinking anything after that in terms of that work. So yeah, it took me a very long while before I was like, no, I'm gonna actually do this, and yeah. I'm gonna put turntablist in there because I am one, and I just yeah. use my own frigging techniques. And also like the fact that it was, so I mentioned Shiva Feshrecki and Mariam Rezai earlier. Like Shiva, later on, what, hang on, 2017, 18, 17, I did a residency with her and a group of other musicians. And that was the first time I'd actually like properly seen another female turntablist and another woman of color doing this. And it was like, it totally blew my mind. And seeing how she interacts with the turntables is so unique to her that it's beautiful, and I love it. And I was just gassed, just like, what? And just really like, just basically fangirling half the time. I was just like, oh my God. And but like that excitement and her presence and just her tutelage made me go, no, I can totally do this. And I know for a fact that like, if somebody like her was like teaching me from an earlier age, yeah. like not necessarily lecturing or whatever, but like about, for me to just get a lesson from mm-hmm. and just learn from, I would have been calling myself a turntablist way earlier. I probably would have made a version of Bashy way earlier. I would have done residencies and other bits, like not only in the UK but abroad, earlier. But like, it's better late than never, don't get me wrong, because yeah. it's taken me a while to get to this point. But you know, it's that visibility of other people's practices, mm-hmm. not just, you know, not just fuddy duddy white men, like just yeah. hello, I'm in tweed, welcome, where's my pipe, like yeah nah, piss off.
Yeah, but
I'm a short black girl with tattoos and a Marvel t-shirt and I scratch, what, you know?
Yeah, but also, you know, the other side of what we think of as turntablism, which is hip hop and, you know, drum and yeah. bass, and to turn up to those spaces and claim to be a turntablist but not be always making music like that, you know, that it's a similar kind of feeling like an other, it's just in a different way.
Yeah, like I've improvised with jazz artists and I've scratched over hip hop beats. I've done all sorts, and you know, I'm very grateful for that. And part of my kind of practice overall is being open minded to working with other musicians in other styles of music. That really challenges me. Like if I feel like, oh, I could do something here, and then just play, and then just see mm-hmm. what happens. That's a part of the fun. I really, it's you know, it's at the end of the day, we're all playing with sound. Like, it's not this weird, like, you got to be grade A, otherwise you're not taken seriously. Like, nah, shut up. Like, you can, we're all playing, we're literally playing with sound. What's the problem? Like, it's not, it doesn't have to be so strict, but yet we've been kind of blindsided, or a lot of people anyway, have been blindsided into thinking that it has to be that strict, and it really doesn't. And
but my theory on it is that it gives people confidence to be in a box. You know, it's safe, it's reliable, it means that you're part of a club. And whether that's, you know, contemporary avant-garde classical music or hip hop or punk or whatever it is, there's certain, you know, certain terminology, certain kit, certain clothes, all that stuff that makes you feel safe and like you're okay, your identity's fixed. And it does, I think it's hard if you're someone that finds it really difficult to just do that for the rest of your life. I can't do that for the rest of my life. Like, I've always been someone that doesn't quite ever really fit in to what I'm doing, and that I, you know, for me, I could have just been a singer-songwriter for the rest of my life. And I, there's no disrespect to people who do that for the whole of their lives. It's just, I that's not the whole of me, you know.
And that's fine, and that's part of the journey. It's just kind of being able to go, do you know what? Like, I'm probably not going to do this forever, and that's also fine if I don't. Like, I remember, so I used to make like hip hop, and kind of like trip hoppy down tempo type of stuff. Then I would easily like knock out an EP in a day and then be done with it. I honestly didn't think of like putting them on, well, Spotify wasn't around then, that's showing my age a bit, but like I didn't think of like, oh, I'm gonna release it and I'm gonna do this. It was just like I had some ideas, and here's essentially a collage, really. Like, here's a collage of sounds I made, and then putting them up and not thinking about them again. And that was kind of like, okay, I've done that for a number of years. Let's see what else I can make if I'm not doing that. And I've had friends in the past go, when's the next beat tape? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, you can't, don't ask me that, because that's gonna make me less likely to make it. So just stop asking me that. I don't want to just make a beat tape for your sake. Like, if that side of me comes back and the music I make manifests into another beat tape, so be it. I don't want to force it. I don't want to, you know, beat myself over the head because I haven't made a beat tape in however many years.
Yeah.
Because I don't have to, and it's fine. And the fact that, like, doing this, like I often say, weird and wonderful stuff, like doing all of this and just really just recording sounds and like doing something as silly as playing with rain, like literally recording rain and then just playing with it and seeing what comes out. And then if I want to add chords later, I might do. And then just that whole process feels really organic and natural to me. And that's where I'm at right now. Yeah. And I've made some beats, yes, but that's how this shit can turn into whatever, whenever it decides to. And I'm not about to force it.
I think Nicole speaks so much sense when it comes to never taking other people's opinions as truth, and how important it is to get started with even a minimal setup and know you can make something authentic and real with very little. If perfectionism, imposter syndrome, and low self-esteem have been holding you back from making creative decisions on your terms, listen to Nicole's golden advice. Peppered throughout Nicole's story and the ideas she shared today is a sense of play and experimentation and a blending of practices to create something truly original. Didn't you just love learning about Pam the Functress's booby DJing as well, though? I, of course, looked that up, and I'm pretty sure I'm just one cup size away from giving her a run for her money. I've linked to the video of Pam for you to check it out for yourself. And you can also go and find out more about Knickknack and her work at knickknackdjmusic.uk. That's knickknackdjmusic.uk. The link is in the show notes. Now, on next week's episode, I'm back with part two of my conversation with Nicole, where we'll be picking up where we left off.
This time we discuss her wonderful album, Bashy, which combines turntable improvisation and field recordings taken from Turkey. We also talk about her experiences as a Black woman in music tech and how we can make the field more inclusive moving forward. So you do not want to miss this one. But till then, take care, and I'll catch you here soon. Girls Twiddling Knobs is hosted and produced by me, Isabel Anderson, with production support from Francesca O'Connor, and is a female DIY musician production. So, how do you like that episode, dear listener? If you loved it, and you know someone else who would love it too, be a good friend and share it with them. Go on, spread the Girls Twiddling Knobs love.